I think most of you know that our final reading will be 1 week from tonight. That's April 23rd in this auditorium. And the reader will be Robert Penn Warren. I hope following the reading tonight you can come over to the Union and meet our visitors from Australia. And we'll have some books available for sale also. We'll be in the terrace lounge, which is on the second floor in the far end of the Union. These Australian visitors are here on a month-long tour of the United States, sponsored in part by the Academy of American Poets and the Library of Congress. They've already read in Hawaii, Oregon, and Utah, and California. We're lucky that they were able to stop off and read for us, too. The first reader tonight will be Les Murray. Mr. Murray comes from New South Wales, and as well as writing poetry, he is an editor and a translator. Les Murray.
I usually read chronologically, old poems, more, less old, and finally recent. This one's the oldest, called The Burning Truck. It began at dawn with fighter planes. They came in off the sea and didn't rise. They leaped the sandbar, one and one and one, coming so fast the crockery they shook down from off my shelves was spinning in the air when they were gone. They came in off the sea and drew a wave of lagging cannon shells across our roofs. Windows spat glass, a truck took sudden fire. Out leaped the driver, but the truck ran on, growing enormous, shambling by our street doors, coming and coming. By every right in town, by every average we knew of in the world, it had to stop. Fetch up against a building, fall to rubble from pure force of burning, for its whole body and substance were consumed with heat. But it would not stop. And all of us who knew our place and prayers clutched our veranda rails and window sills, begging that truck between our teeth to halt, keep going, vanish, strike, but set us free. And then we saw the wild boys of the street go running after it. And as they followed, cheering, on it crept, windshield melting now, canopy frame, a cage torn by gorillas of flame. And it kept on over the tram lines, past the church, on past the last lit windows, and then out of the world with its disciples. The main square in Sydney is called Martin Place. Sydney is about 3 million people. An absolutely ordinary rainbow. The word goes round Repens, the murmur goes round Laurencini's. At Tattersall's, men look up from sheets of numbers. The stock exchange scribblers forget the chalk in their hands, and men with bread in their pockets leave the Greek club. There's a fella crying in Martin Place, they can't stop him. The traffic in George Street is banked up for half a mile and drained of motion. The crowds are edgy with talk, and more crowds come hurrying. Many run in the back streets, which minutes ago were busy main streets, pointing, there's a fellow weeping down there, no one can stop him. The man we surround, the man no one approaches, simply weeps and doesn't cover it. Weeps, not like the wind, not like a child, like a man, and doesn't declaim it, nor beat his breast, nor even sob very loudly. Yet the dignity of his weeping holds us back from his space, the hollow he makes about him in the midday light in his pentagram of sorrow. And uniforms back in the crowd who tried to seize him stare out at him and feel with amazement their minds longing for tears as children for a rainbow. Some will say in the years to come a halo or force stood round him. There is no such thing. Some will say they were shocked and would have stopped him, but they will not have been there. The fiercest manhood, the toughest reserve, the slickest wit amongst us trembles with silence and burns with unexpected judgments of peace. Some in the concourse scream who thought themselves happy. Only the smallest children and such as look out of paradise come near him and sit at his feet with dogs and dusty pigeons. Ridiculous, says a man near me, and stops his mouth with his hands as if it uttered vomit. And I see a woman shining stretch her hand and shake as she receives the gift of weeping. As many as follow her also receive it. And many weep for sheer acceptance, and more refuse to weep for fear of all acceptance. But the weeping man, like the earth, requires nothing. The man who weeps ignores us and cries out of his writhen face and ordinary body not words but grief, not messages but sorrow, hard as the earth, sheer, present as the sea. And when he stops, he simply walks between us, mopping his face with the dignity of one man who has wept and now has finished weeping. Evading believers, he hurries off down Pitt Street. Kiss of the Whip. In Cardiff, off St. Mary's Street, there in the pawn shops you could get a magazine called Kiss of the Whip. I used to pretend I'd had poems in it. Kiss of the Whip, I never saw it. I might have encountered familiar skills, having been raised in a stock whip culture. Grandfather could dock a black snake's head. Stanley would crack the snake for preference, leap from his horse, grab, whirl and jolt, the popped head hum from his one-shot slingshot. The whips themselves were black, fine, braided, arm-coiling beasts that could suddenly flourish and cut a cannibal strip from a bull, millisecond returns, or idly behead an ant on the track. My father did that. A knot in the lash would kill a rabbit. There were decencies. Good dogs and children were flogged with the same lash, doubled back. A horsehair plait on the tip for a cracker sharpened the note. For 10 or 12,000 years, this was the sonic barrier's one human fracture. Whip-cracking is that. Thonged lightning making the leanest thunder. When black snakes go to hell, they are affixed by their fangs to carved whip handles and fed on nothing but noonday heat, sweat, and flowing rumps and language. They writhe up dust storms for revenge and send them roaring where creature comforts got with a touch of the lash. And that is a temple yard that'll bear more cleansing. Before, through droughts and barracks, those lax, quiet speaking, sudden fellas emerge where skill unbraids from death, unmastering, in St. Mary's Street. In this one, I imagined a couple of chaps coming back to live in the country after travel. It's called The Returnees. As we were rowing to the lakes, our oars were blunt and steady wings. The tan-bark-coloured water was a gruel of pollen. More coming down hinted strange futures to ourselves. The far hills ancient under it, the corn flats black-green under heat, were cut in an antique grainy gold. It was the light of Boeotian art. Bestowing tourbillons that drowned the dusty light we had used up, pulling the distance to us, we were conscious of a lifelong sound on everything. That low, fly-humming, melismatic, untedious, endless note that a drone pipe plus chants or a ballad, some ballads, catch. The one some paintings and many yarners summon, the ground note here of unsnubbing art. Cicadas were in it, and that gothic towering of crystals in the trees. Still hearing, we saw a snake ahead, winding, being his own snorkel. Aslant in the swimming highlights, only his head betrayed him, leading two ripples and a scaled-down swirl. We edged closer, were defied and breathed at. A migrant, perhaps? A pioneer? Or had a hunting bird dropped him, missing the organ-busting ground, and even the flat of the drinking ground? Touching the oars and riding, we kept up with the blunt, heat-tasting head, debating its life and sparing it, which is the good of Athens. Where the rotted milk wharf took the sun, flint-hard on top, dappling below, remembered children danced up there, spinning their partners, the bright steel cans. A way of life, but a way of life. The snake rose like a Viking ship, signed mud with a scattering flourish, and was into the whale of potato ground like a whip withdrawn. We punted off. Oar leather jumping in spaced kicks against the swivel screw of rollocks, we hauled the slow bush headlands near, drinking beer and talking a bit. Such friendliness shone into us, such dry, complex cheer. Insouciant calm out of everything, the brain-shaped trees, the wrinkling middle gleam, the still indifferently well-wooded hills. It was like rowing to meet your very best passionately casual and dead friends and feast with them on a little island. Or an angel leaning down to one queuing on the day to ask, what was the best throw that you did? That note, raised to the pitch of tears, tower of joking, star of skill, gate of sardonyx and worn gold. Blackman and Rosenberg and I have beliefs in common, I exclaimed, and you were agreeing that Mao Zedong had somehow come to Dunsinane. Any more heightening and it would have been a test. But the centre we had stirred stopped down again one notch to happiness, and we were let dip our points in the wide, stopped water and reclaim our motion. Bloodwood trees round there were in such a froth of bloom that honey dripped on shale and gummed blady grass in wigwams and ant towns. Sweetness infusing followed us. Reality is somebody's, you said, with a new and wryly balanced smile. We're country and western, I replied. The future. There is nothing about it. Much science fiction is set there, but it's not about it. Prophecy is not about it. It sways no yarrow stalks, and crystal is a mirror. Even the man we nailed on a tree for a lookout said little about it. He told us evil would come. We see by convention a small living distance into it, but even that's a projection. And all our projections fail to curve where it curves. It is the black hole out of which no radiation escapes to us. The commonplace and magnificent roads of our lives go on some way through cityscape and landscape or steeply sloping or scree into that sheer fall where everything will be that we have ever sent there, compacted, spinning, except perhaps us to see it. It said we see the start. But from here there's a blindness. The cavern future that will swallow all our present blinds us to the normal sun that may be imagined shining calmly away on the far side of it for others in their ordinary day. A day to which all our portraits, ideals, revolutions, denim and déshabille are quaintly heartrending. To see those people is impossible. To greet them, mawkish. Nonetheless, I begin when I was alive, and I am turned around to find myself looking at a cheerful picnic party, the women decently legless in muslin and gloves, the men in beards and waistcoats with the long cheroots and duck trousers of the better sort, relaxing on a stone veranda, Ceylon or Sydney. And as I look, I know they are utterly gone, each one on his day with pillows, small bottles, mist, with all the futures they dreamed or dealt in, going down to that engulfment everything approaches. With the man on the tree, they have vanished into the future. Where I come from is above Sydney, about 200 miles on the east coast of Australia. It's fairly green country, forested country. These place names in this poem refer to spots around the Manning River and a bit to the south of there, the country I come from. Now the sun is an apple-green blindness through the swells, a white blast on the sea face, flaking and shoaling. Now it is burning off the mist, it is emptying the density of trees, it is spreading upriver, hovering above the casuarina needles, there at Old Bar and Manning Point. Flooding the island farms, it abolishes the milkers' munching breath as they walk towards the cowyards. It stings a bucket here, a titcup there. Morning steps into the world by ever more southerly gates. Shadows weaken their north skew on Middle Brother, on Cape Hawk, on the dune scrub towards Seal Rocks. Steadily the heat is coming on, the butterwater time, the clothes-sticking time. Grass covers itself with straw, abandoned things are thronged with spirits. Everywhere wood is still with strain, birds hiding down the creek galleries and in the Cocksburg canes. The cicada is hanging up her sheets. She takes wing off her music sheets. Cars pass with a rational zoom, panning quickly towards Wingham, through the thronged and glittering, the shale-topped ridges and the cattle camps, towards Wingham for the cricket, the ball knocked hard in front of smoked glass ranges, and for the drinking. In the time of heat, the time of flies around the mouth, the time of the west veranda, looking at that umbrage along the ranges on the New England side. Clouds begin assembling vaguely, a hot, soiled heaviness on the sky away there towards Gloucester. A swelling up of clouds growing there above Mount George and above Tipperary, far away and hot with light. Sometimes a storm takes root there and fills the heavens rapidly, darkening, boiling up and swaying on its stalks, pulling this way and that, blowing round by Cranbeck, coming white on Bulby Mountain and drenches down on the paddocks and on the wire fences. The paddocks are full of ghosts and people in cornbag hoods approaching. Lights are lit in the house. The storm veers mightily on its stem above the roof. The hills uphold it. The stony hills guide its dissolution. Gullies opening and crumbling down, wrenching tussocks and rolling them. The storm carries a greenish-grey bag. Perhaps it will find hail and send it down, starring cars, flattening tomatoes. In the time of the washaways, of the dead trunks braiding water, and of the hailstone yarns. Oh, the air's dry here. I kind of like it that way. Here's a fairly dry one in return. It's called Employment for the Cast in Abeyance. I was a translator at the Institute. Fair pay, clean work, and a bowerbird's delight of theory and fact to keep the forebrain souple. I was Western Europe. Beiträge, Reviste, Dissertatis, Rapport turned English under my one-fingered touch. Teacup and Remington days. It was a job like Australia, peace and cover. A recourse for exiles, poets, decent spies, for plotters who meant to rise from the dead with their circle. My Chekhovian colleague, who worked as if under surveillance, would tell me tales of real life in Peking and Shanghai and swear at the gender subsumed in an equation. The trade was uneasy about computers back then. If they could be taught not to render, say, out of sight, out of mind, as invisible lunatic, they might supersede us. Not because they'd be better, or on principle. Not that our researchers were unkindly folk. One man on exchange from Moscow State told me about Earth's crustal plates, their ponderous inevitable motion, collisions that raised mountain chains. The continents rode on these Marxian turtles, it seemed. Another had brought slow death to a billion rabbits. A third man had bottled the essence of rain on dry ground. They were translators too, our scientists. They were translating the universe into science, believing that otherwise it had no meaning. Leaving there, I kept my Larousse and my Leutseligkeit, and I heard that machine translation never happened, that language defeated it. We are a language species. I gather this provoked a shift in science, that having become a side, it then changed sides, and having collapsed, continued at full tempo. Prince Obolensky succeeded me for a time, but he soon returned to Fiji to teach Hebrew. In the midst of life, we are in employment. Seek, travel, and print. Seek, left, right, travel, and bang, as the Chinese typewriter went, which I saw working when I was a translator at the Institute. I'll finish up with some recent ones. One of the dry land phenomena I've always been fascinated with is those curls of mud that you get on the bottom of dry lakes, dry lagoons. And I got down to this fascination and wrote this poem called The Craze Field. These lagoons, these anabranches, streets of the underworld, Their water has become the trees that stand along them. Below root revetments in the circles of the water's recession, the ravines seem thronged with a legacy of lily pads. Earth curls and faintly glistens, scumbled paintily and peeling. Pellets of drought-stilled assonance, they are cupped flakes of grit, crisps of bottom, dried meniscus lifted at the edges. Abstracts realized in slime, shards of bubble, shriveled viscose of clay and stopped life. The scales of the water snake have gone to grey on this channel. Exfoliate bark of the rain tree, all the outer plaques have a jostling average size. It is a kind of fire, the invention of networks. Water's return, however gradual, and it won't be, however gentle, it won't be, would not relay all seamless this basal membrane. It has borne excess of clarity. This is the lush sheet that overlay the first cities, the mother goddess towns, but underlay them first. This they had for mortar. Lamina, half detached, these cusps are primal tissue, foreshadowings of leaf, pottery, palimpsest, the dead lagoon scrolls. In this hollow season, everything is perhaps to be recapitulated, hurriedly, approximately. It is a kind of fire. Saturate calm is all sprung in the mother country. The lagoon bed museums, meanwhile, have a dizzy stillness that will reduce with all the steps that are coming to meal, grist, morsels. Dewfall and birds' feet have nipped, blind noons have nibbled this mineral matzah. The warlike peace-talking young, pacing this dominion in the beautiful flesh that outdoes their own creations, might read gnomic fragments, core, lux, romant, irid, or fragmentary texts. Who lose belief in God will not only believe in anything, they will bring blood offerings to it. Bones, snags, seed capsules, intrinsic in the Martian central pan, are hidden in the craze under small pagoda leaves. This one's for bed. One of my favourite places, bed. And no matter how far you travel, you can always find it, you know, you'll always be there. Homage to the launching place. Pleasure craft of the sprung rhythms, bed, kindest of quadrupeds. You are also the unrocking boat that moves on silence. Straining hatchway into this world, you sustain our collapses above earth. Guarantor of evolution, you are our raised baseline. Resisting gravity for us and in us, you form a planet-wide, unobtrusive, discontinuous layer, the matrosphere. Pretty nearly our highest common level, tables may dispute it. Muscles, sweat-printed solace, godmother of butt-stubbing dreams, you sublimate, great vehicle, all our upright passions. Midwife of figuring and design, you moderate them wisely. You sigh, think some more, sleep on it. Solitude approaching rest, time reveals her oscillation and narrows into space. There is time in that dilation, mansions, defiles, continents, the living and the greatly living. Objects that take sides, that aren't morally neutral. You accept my warm absence there as you will accept one day my cooling presence. I loved you from the first bed, doorway out of this world. Above your inner springs I learned to dig my own. Primly dressed, linen-collared one, you look so still for your speed. Shield that carries us to the fight and bears us from it. And finally, there's a subject I've been after for a long time, which is interest. Not money interest, but the other one, you know, to be interested in, to be interested by something. This one was my first try at it. It's called First Essay on Interest. Not usury, but interest. The cup slowed in mid-raise, the short whistle, hum, the little forward shift mark our intake of that non-physical breath, for which the lungs suspend, since the self vanishes, angled to that form of love, oscillating with it. A blink returns us to self, that intimate anger, self-repairing as a bow wave. What we have received is the ordinary mail of the other world, wholly common, not postmarked divine, no one refuses delivery. Not even the eagle, her face fixed at heavy menace. I have juices to sort the relevant from the irrelevant. Even her gaze may tilt left, askance, aloof, right. Fixing a still unknown, delaying huge flight. Interest, mild and inherent with fire as oxygen. It is a sporadic inhalation. We can live for years under its surface, breathing material air. Then something catches, is itself. Intent and special silence. This is interest that blinks our interests out, and alone permits their survival by relieving us of their gravity for a timeless moment. That centers where it points and points to centering. That centers us where it points and reflects our center. And this breath of interest is non-rhythmical. It is human to obey, humane to be wary of rhythm, as tainted by the rallies, as marching with the snare drum. The season of interest is not fixed in the calendar cycle. It pulls towards acute dimensions. Death is its intimate. When that Holland of cycles, the body, turns headlong downhill, interest retreats from the face. It ceases to instill and fade like breath. It becomes a vivid, steady state that registers every grass blade seen on the way, the long, combed grain in the steps, free insects flying. It stands aside from your panic, the rack disarray. It behaves as if it were the part of you not dying. Affinity of interest with extremity seems to distill to this polar disaffinity. To learn where their dance ends will be interesting. Thank you.
Vincent Buckley was born in Victoria and currently lives and teaches at university in Melbourne. As well as a poet, he is very well known in his country for his essays and literary criticism. Vincent Buckley.
Thank you. I'd like, first of all, to say how much we appreciate the thoughtfulness and generosity of the Academy of American Poets the hospitality of all the centers that we've been to. We're particularly glad to come to Tucson. It was no afterthought on anybody's part, because we know perfectly well that this is a very important center for poetry in America. And I'd like to say publicly how much we appreciate the hospitality we've been given. We also have, of course, behind us a bit of Australian money, but we are not Australian government agents. Well, first of all, I would like to read some poems, all of them short, from a book called Golden Builders, which is out of print now. The first poem I'll read is a poem about a racehorse. Australia has an enormous horse racing industry, and we import American sires, and we export Australian sires and their progeny to America as well as to other places. This particular poem is called Dual Choice. Dual Choice was a mare, a very fine sprinter, who used to gallop very close to the ground. I imagine she would have been in trouble if she tried to do anything else, but anyway, she did. It's called Daisy Cutting Action. And the motto for this poem is something I once heard said by one of the Irish show jumping team, Commandant Campion. He said, "The rider gets his courage from the horse," which I think is a remark which might apply to poetry as well as to many other things. Heat's whetstone in the sky, the air like sparks bringing out red in every color. She trembles down each muscle. Rain flecks quick as flies nerve her shoulder. Hoof stamps in her circling, till running between these gates, they strike grass with a pricking sound. Small birds rise, dozens, along the margins of their running, float sticky as bats, and his knees, loins drive her round the long corner. No whip, but the whole arm driving back from her shoulder, the beautiful short body almost sedate, patient in its speed. The 4 feet cleanly meeting, neck arched like a stallion's, wind blowing out of the sun, light flashing on sweeps of cars, fans through shade deliver at the post the plunging stride, breastplate, curved whip, bare nostril, the long taped Egyptian faces. Now I would like to read 3 or 4 poems from a sequence called Golden Builders, the nature of which I won't try to explain to you because it would take too long. I'll simply say that the motto for this poem was some lines from William Blake's Jerusalem. What are those golden builders doing? Where was the burying place of soft Athinthus near Tyburn's fatal tree? Is that mile Zion Hill's most ancient promontory near mournful, ever-weeping Paddington? And as you might suspect from that, the sequence has to do with the destruction and building of places and of lives. And the first poem in it mentions a lot of street names, and many of these are all street names of places near the University of Melbourne in an area which was for a long time, when I lived in it, a slum area. And the names are mostly the names of English noblemen, because of course all the Australian cities are founded on and are named in part after British rulers, we being a colonial society. The hammers of iron glow down Faraday. Ligon and Drummond shift under their resonance. Saws and hammers drawn across the bending air, shuttling like a bow. The saw trembles, the hammers are molten, they glow with quick light striking. The flush spreads and deepens on the stone. The drills call the streets together, stretching hall to lecture room to hospital. But prop old walls with battens of old wood. Saturday work, Sabbath work. On this day we laid this stone to open this Sabbath school. Feed my lambs. The sun dies half glowing in the floating brick dust, suspended between red and saffron. The colors resonate like a noise. The muscles of mouth, neck, shoulders, loins arm themselves against it. Pavements clink like steel. The air, soft, palpable as cork, lets the stone cornices gasp into it. Pelham surrenders. Grattan runs leaning forward, seeking the garden's breadth, the fearful edge of green on which the sexes lay. We have built this Sabbath school. Feed my lambs. Evening wanders through my hands and feet. My mouth as cool as the air that now thins, twitching the lights on down winding paths. Everything leans on this bright cold. In gaps of lanes, in tingling, shabby squares, I hear the crying of the machines. O Cardigan, Queensbury, Elgin, names of their lordships. Cardigan, Elgin, Ligon, shall I find here my lord's grave? The next poem from the sequence is called Blake in the Body. It concerns the fact that Blake left London, as far as I know, only for one period of his life, and that was to go to the coast of Sussex at Philpham, which he didn't like, and where he got into a lot of trouble and was arrested on a charge of treason. Half-made London, blotched green fields, and you with your boxer's face, the broad lime-white forehead borne down on thick eyelids, the mouth muscling down, you came south to Philpham. Prophet to the watering places, Cockney tradesman at the seaside, your boxer's head set at an angle for the sea air. It was light leaping all through the house, the unpruned vine reached to the roof angles. In the long, tilting, stiff grass paddocks, with ecstasy you heard the ploughboy say, "The gates are open, father, the gates are open." The twinned harrow's tines shone like earthshine. Later, you called it your 3 years' slumber on the banks of ocean. who did not sleep all night. And finally, from this book in sequence, a poem about nearly being electrocuted and not quite succeeding in being electrocuted. The traffic glitters towards dull junction. It inches forward in the muscles of my face, crush forward in the agony of an eyeball. My shoulders push against it. The smell tangible as a stain. And for no reason, I catch the vinegar smell of fresh sweat in the thin hairs of my arm. And taste again fire and alloy, echo of the death evening when, stunned on the floor, on my elbow, metal flamed in my mouth, my palm was struck metal black, my body cold and lustrous metal. One more day of my life was dying. The yellow bloomed in the pavement, and the cool rang through every nerve and surface. At the window, risen from the dead, I sat thinking of the seahorse, dropping his children like seeds about him, keeping his eye on them, so they float riderless in the water, drawn about him. And I'd like to read some poems now from this book, Late Winter Child, which has to do with the life of my third daughter. It's addressed to my wife and to my third daughter, and it concerns that whole very important length of time when the first of these was bearing the second in the womb. And these are very short poems. I'll read five or six of them. They're not in sequence, but I'll read them as they were. Gently rounded as your hips in the yellow caftan, we'll hear him sometime whistling and changing in your body, your flesh and blood. Sweet William with candy tuft in the one bowl I brought you. Stationed here, we'll wait as he strains into his clinging tent of waters, waiting for fins, for eyes bulbing, for breath itching at the dance-like morning. Before the phone shrills, there is a ticking in the wood beside it. Gardens rise level as platforms, pressing their smell through every leaf. We spent our summers preparing a late winter child. But I'd grown with you 15 years. Was I to lose you now you were distant with child, your eyes drawling like a sleepwalker's feet? And morning, I'd say, where is the morning of rain and the strong bright light that pricks up our eyes, and the park where I would hope to see you running the dog beside you, and under the belted raincoat that hides your body's lines of heat, cool linen on your shoulders. You called when we were sleeping from that room we shared, that bed where I'd waited listening for the birth sounds, so often cool as linen on your breast. Beyond the furthest dream shapes, your face closed like a story, told endlessly in the room where I'd come in out of the white photographed heat to find you leaning in your double weight, cool linen on your shoulders. The dream child is curious. At 5 months you dreamed it leaned out of your body in its own dream to smile at an approaching child. I think of its eyes opened in greeting, its hands trailing drops of clear water, as if an animal walked out and drew lines in the clearing for a new city. In your heat, my breath surrounds you. 12 months, the thought of lightning glided across your birthday. The heat was heavy as water. Low cloud shivered with light. A waste between us. I should have told you then death was your rival, that darkened my brain with fears, plans, the thin copper movements of a worm on the hot stone. Instead, I listened for the velvet sounds, moths, door handles, the rise of a footstep, The combs hiss over the hair, its parting tightened by summer. My eyes carried all day their pinpoint of blood. All day I was the object in your path, giving no echo. Go on to another book now. This one is called The Pattern, and it's a book chiefly about places and people in Ireland and in parts of Australia which continue Irish traditions. First I'll read is about my grandfather's house in Australia. He was an Irishman, and it's addressed to my mother. The pale blue child of Mary Cape is an object which will be familiar to a small minority of you, I'm sure, but it has very little significance in the poem, except to give a connotation of Catholic piety to the place. And the last line refers to the character of Emily Bronte. No place was like your father's house. I followed you round and round, grinning, nervy with your pleasure. Even when bedded down, fatigued with ancestry, kneeing the blankets, I heard their soft laughter rustling the kitchen, and over the orchard's dung smells, the apple trees made their furred sound of green moving. It was as though I lay along the buds of my mother's body. So close to sleep, I felt the farm sliding in water, myself growing crafty as a farmer. All of it hovered on the edge of outcry. A first frail paradise, where the dream let down like tendrils, entering through air the airless sponge that would sometime be memory. Behind the door, the pale blue child of Mary Cape, unfamiliar coat, spittle, pipe smell. Drifting in with an animal wholeness through the propped window, the birds, their beaks opening with the slowness of fire, stung at the trees. Your father held out the sovereigns to us in their shapely box, roughened by his hands. And you lived thereafter in the unlike house, whose rose-light side windows shed ovals, where the dust shimmered always with its few motes, and the sunlight entered from the north. Room by room you circled it, open as a razor, walked out carrying the axe into sunlight, quivered with the fowls, but let me see your arms froth in the entrails, fine brown-featured and tense like a surviving Bronte. This one is about Australia and Ireland. It's called The Blind School. And it's not a very long poem, but it's in three short sections. I have to explain something about this. It's about a time, a couple of years ago, when I was living in a house right opposite the gateway to St. Paul's Blind School, a school for blind children. And the children in the school were not only blind, but mentally retarded. And you would often pass them in the street, but as well as that, you would hear them on some nights crying very piteously in the institution. And at that time, my daughter was about 12 months old, and she was perfectly fit and sound in every respect, except that she had a dreadful hatred of going to sleep. And it seemed to me that there was something in from off my skin, thick spume, blood, mouse matter fled into your dreams. Cicadas steam at the earth under the blind school. Behind the gauzy wire there are gusts of shrilling. In the clear space of your parents' bed you sob with closed eyes, your voice a flashlight ebbing in the dark around me. In the famine years, Skull was a place of skeletons. They sat propped in the streets, each cabin inside its bourne of spit and blood-clotted feces. Skibbereen also was a famine centre, There, in a parish of 18,000, there were 50 deaths every day. The corn store at Durrus was filled with children. All were dying. Look there, sir, you cannot tell whether they are boys or girls. Their legs swing and rock like the legs of a doll. Sir, they have the smell of mice. Every one of them is in famine fever, a fever so sticky it never leaves them. Dying to sleep, not knowing how to begin that slow climb down, you hold my clock on the pillow, its gold-black face, its hands sticking on 12, and you burrow back, down towards the unimaginable center, angrily, "Mama, Mama," whose hair is moving in the glistenings of streetlight. Now, perhaps I have time for a couple more recent poems, unpublished poems. First of these mentions two poets from the classical Chinese anthology, and in the center of the poem are two lines from Arthur Whaley's translation of one of these two poets, Bo Chui. Bo Chui, choked with the age-old fogs of office, seeing the moon clean as the glass he drained, got up from his chair. So many dead. That's when he cried out, looking up at the red shoots of sunset, "Looking for each other, we have all grown grey." His great soft cry for the dead. "When shall we meet and drink a cup of wine?" Calling them into the moonlight. And thinking of my dead friends, I pick up a stick and tap it lightly on the ground as Bo Chui. Or like Li Bo, look downward, drain my glass, go forward, slowly, drunk, to the river. Next one is called Men of Appin, and it concerns a mine disaster in New South Wales last year, in which a number of men were killed. Sudden modern cold pit, as blast-scarred as the gravel mountains where the sheep scattered the small bone bodies of their fathers under a sky red with cold. How well can we sleep? Better than the men of Appin, carried in their shrouds like hammocks, up the coal-black death canal to the blunt light and the square hands, restless on the morning papers. Outside the washed-out world of news, the light drumming on their windows and on their wives' and children's faces. Their mates said they were all good men, good mates, good men to work with. How could you love this land? Not more than the men of Appin, crouched intently towards their graves, had when drugged they drank the gas like water, fell by the pit wall, hard by Dapto and its harbour. Thank you.
David Malouf was born in Brisbane. In recent years, he's divided his time between a home in Italy and home in Australia. As well as writing poetry, he writes novels. His two most recent books are published by Brazzler here in the United States. The most recent book of poems is called The Year of the Foxes. And though we won't have copies of those available tonight, they will be available in the bookstore soon. David Malouf.
I'm going to read first some poems and then a couple of passages from the novel. The book published by Brazilla, by the way, the Book of Poems, isn't in fact my latest book, really. It's my very first book in Australia, which has been reprinted here. It's quite an old book. But this first poem is called Early Discoveries. My grandfather came from Lebanon in the 1880s and learned to speak no English. And the poem is about that. The only two references I think that will be difficult are A Webb's Wonder, if you don't have such a thing in the United States, is a form of lettuce. Zuckley is the name of a town in Lebanon, Chios is an island in Greece, and you might remember that the seasons are completely upside down in Australia. That helps. Early discoveries. I find him in the garden. Staked tomato plants are what he walks among, the apples of paradise. He is 80 and stoops, white-haired in baggy serge and braces. His moustache, once warrior fierce for quarrels in the small town of Zachli, where honour divides houses, empties squares, droops and is thin from stroking. He has come too far from his century to care for more than these, the simplest ones, Webb's wonders, salad harmless, stripped by the birds. He pantomimes a dervish dance amongst them, and the birds creak off, his place at evening filled by a stick that flares and swipes at air, a pinstriped waistcoat stuffed with straw. It cuffs and swivels. I'm scared of it. Such temper tantrums are unpredictable, blind buffeting of storms that rattle Venetians, kiss off pavements in the sun. Grandpa is milder, but when he hefts as high, his white hairs prickle, and the smell is foreign. Is it garlic or old age? They are continents I have not happened on. Their time will come. Meanwhile, he mutters blessings. I watch him practice his odd rites, hatchet in hand, as he martyrs chickens in the woodblocks dark, an old man struggling with wings, or shakes a sieve while bright grain showers in a heap, and blown chaff flies and glitters, falling to the other mouths. He comes and goes with daylight. He is the lord of vegetables, the scourge of nuns and birds, those shoe-black crows his sullen daughters taunt him with. His black sheep son feeds rabbits live to greyhounds in a cage behind choco vines. The girls, too, go to the bad in a foreign land, consorting with Carmelites, on hot nights tossing in their high beds in a riot of lace doilies, painted virgins, unwed. They dwell in another land, as I do, his eldest grandson, aged 4, where I nose through dusty beanstalks, searching for brothers under 9-week cabbages. He finds me there, and I dig behind his shadow down the rows. This is his garden, a valley in Lebanon. You can smell the cedars on his breath and the blood of massacres, the crescent flashing from ravines to slice through half a family. He rolls furred sage between thumb and stained forefinger, sniffs the snowy hills, bees shifting gold as they forage sunlight among stones, church bells wading in through pools of silence. He has never quite migrated. The weather in his head, still upside down, as out of season snow falls from his eyes on Queensland's green, and January's midwinter still, these swelling suns are miracles, tomatoes in invisible glass houses sweat in the heat of his attention, like islands Columbus happens on, and me, whom he also finds, squatting, eggplant tall, and puzzled by his dark hands parting the stems. Where am I? This is Brisbane, our backyard. We let him garden here behind the lattice wall. This house is ours and home. He comes like a stranger, warrior mustachioed and English. These days, I find him at all turns. One morning early, in Chios, I raise the shutter, and his garden rediscovered shines, cucumbers, spinach, trellised vines. The old man finds me watching, smiles and nods. Later, fresh on the marble step, in yesterday's newspaper, words of a tongue I cannot read, his offering, two heads of new spring cabbage. I look under the leaves, an ancient joke, there's nothing there. Just a sprinkling of black soil on the headlines of another war, shaken from the roots. That night, I eat them, boiled, with oil and vinegar. Second poem is a very short poem, which attempts to reproduce something of the place I come from in Australia, which is subtropical, northern, which in your terms means southern, about the equivalent of Georgia. It's called an Ordinary Evening in Hamilton. The garden shifts indoors. The house lets fall its lamplight, opens windows in the earth. And the small stars of the grass, the night insects, needlepoint a jungle more dense than any tapestry, where Saturn burns a snow owl's nest, and melons feed their crystal with hot sugars of the moon. The Pacific breaks at our table, each grain of salt, a splinter of its light at midday, deserts flare on the lizard's tongue. Familiar rooms glow rise through the dark, exotic islands. This house, a strange anatomy of parts, so many neighbors in a thicket, hair, eye tooth, thumb. This poem is called A Poet Among Others. It has a very brief epigraph, which is from Nadezhda Mandelstein. I'll read that quickly. A poet, after all, is just a human being like any other, and he is bound to end up in the most ordinary way, in the way most typical for his age and his times, meeting the fate that lies in wait for everyone else. The self is like smoke, drifting up at dawn. A fist can't hold it, a knotted handkerchief. It fades into grey winter skies. It goes where the birds go, when water cracks in pools and is no window. Grey faces, grey serge uniforms in the frozen yard, a roll call without names. Midday strikes, clean through these ghosts, no longer citizens. These shadows, herded behind a winter palisade, they cannot pass through to swollen fields, to thresholds they cross only in dreams, at first light hunted from Petersburg. They have fallen out of favor. It's a long way down. And the state is everywhere. In a man's guts it aches. In the ear of corn it shouts its slogans. In a thick skull lodges its bird songs like lead. The way to freedom is thin smoke ascending, a road that winds out of the hands. Birds perched on the wire go there, fly in, light on your wrist with a scent of pine wood, can be cast into the air and over the stockade out. Even the grass is innocent, goes on, growing beyond a wall. In such a century, the grass is fortunate. The state cares only for men. This one was a poet, holding to the isness of things, a blade of rye, a moment spiraling up from the stubble field on a lark's wing to enter the whole day's blue, a water drop filled with the light of Caucasus, a woman's face clenched on its grief. He shares it now, the commonness of what is human, grey, grey as the dirt with its many grains, each one identical and singing. The earth in his mouth at last, heavy as silence, where the unkillable grass seed takes root under his tongue. Sorry, I'm a victim of your dry air. These three short poems come from a sequence which is called The Little Panopticon. Each of them has the name of a famous book and is as much like what the name of the book might suggest as possible. The first one is called The Elements of Geometry. It's the town is Florence. In this banker's town, of course, art would depend on figures, angles, rules of thumb. The shadow of the Palazzo Vecchio shifts across the air, a slow diagonal, cutting violets with its edge of ice, an imaginary triangle of which my clenched fist is the base, and Judith's upraised cleaver one point, the Banca Toscana perhaps another, or the sun that holds in focus a province and its skulls. How curious, Dante, that our lines of life should intersect in this narrow street. You going your way to the exile's tomb, I seeking mine. This line of thought extended downward would pass through New Zealand, and upwards might divide the fathers of the church in holy schism. Spaces gather in the evening light, huge, solemn, empty, howling for blue, to be occupied with small events from the passion of a saint, or miracles in the repertoire of God. What feeling is it for the structure of things, another law, that makes this old man pause at the mathematical center of the square? There are other kingdoms than nature. This city is the capital of more than Tuscany. All lines meet here. The bright cube opens, turns, and splits in segments. We enter at a tangent to the field, our only asset, an eye and its mechanics, the ground rules of a discipline. This one is called 1001 Nights, and is a tribute to the art of narrative, which I think of in terms of providence itself. 1001 Nights. A boy stops, open-mouthed, between one breath and the next, travels to Baghdad via Kathmandu and back. 2 decades later, finds the apple in his hand, still untasted. Another boy, whose life the first boy enters through the eye of a tailor's needle, whose dreams, in the steam of a shaving basin, show his face agape, loiters beside a blacksmith shop and enters halfway through the third boy's adventures, for 7 years spellbound, wrecked among brutes on a black coast, riding in oil jars with the old man of the mountains. Magnetized by chains of such events, and then, whose lifetime has he spent? A storyteller, sewing strips of hide, announces what happens to us next, and we are held, whispering, "Please don't let me wake. Don't let me fall. Don't let me ever get home. Don't let the story end." Which is perhaps a point at which I might move to something from the novel. I'm going to read the beginning and the very end, and a piece in between. The beginning explains itself completely, I think. When I first saw the child, I cannot say. I see myself, I might be 3 or 4 years old, playing under the olives at the edge of our farm, just within call of the goat herd. And I am talking to the child, whether for the first time or not, I cannot tell at this distance. The goat herd is dozing against an olive bowl, his head rolled back to show the dark line of his jaw, and the sinews of his scraggy neck, the black mouth gaping. Bees shift among the herbs. The air glitters. It must be late summer. There are wind-blown poppies in the grass. A black he-goat is up on his hind legs, reaching for vine shoots. The child is there. I am 3 or 4 years old. It is late summer. It is spring. I am 6. I am 8. The child is always the same age. We speak to one another, but in a tongue of our own devising. My brother, who is a year older, does not see him, even when he moves close between us. He is a wild boy. I have heard the goat herd speak of a wild boy, whether this one or another, I do not know. And of course I do not admit to them or to anyone that I know him. The wild boy they speak of lives among wolves in the ravines to the east, beyond the cultivated farms and villas of our well-watered valley. There really are wolves out there. I have heard stories of how they raid the outlying pastures, and once I think I heard one howling in the snow, unless it was the child. And I've seen a wolf's head that one of the hunters brought back to hang up as a warning in the fold. It was grey and not very fierce-looking, despite the curling back of the flesh over its fanged jaw. I thought of the child, and how wolves must have something in their nature which is kindly and which connects with our kind, or else how could the child live among them? What was frightening was the way the head had been hacked off, with ropes of dark blood hanging from it, and the fur at its throat matted with blood. Later I heard, again from the goat herds perhaps, that there is indeed some part of our nature that we share with wolves, and something of their nature that is in us, since there are men at certain phases of the moon who can transform themselves into wolves. They close their human mind like a fist, and when they open it again, it is a wolf's paw. The skull bulges, the jaw pushes out to become a snout, hair prickles down their spine, grows rough on their belly. The body slouches and is on all fours, the voice thickens. It is the moon draws them on. I believed such things in those days and wondered, was the child a wolf boy? Were those wolf men who lived secretly among us, changing themselves painfully at the moon's bidding, children who had been captured from the wilds and brought in among us to be adapted to the ways of men? Sometime when my own body began to change, and I discovered the first signs of manhood upon me, the child left and did not reappear. Though I dreamt of him often enough in those early years, and have done so since, I have forgotten the language we used, and if he were to reappear, perhaps, we could no longer communicate. Did he have some message for me then? If so, he failed to deliver it. Or did so, and it has slipped my mind. Or the language he used on whatever occasion it was had already passed my understanding and could not be translated into daily speech. I think I have always believed, that he will come again, but in what guise? The speaker of that is in fact Ovid. He is exiled, as you may or may not know, to Scythia, the very height of his career. And the form of that punishment really was to deprive him completely of language, since he was taken to a place where people spoke neither Latin nor Greek. And in that place, he hears of a wild child and tempts the people of the village to go out and capture the child. What I'm reading now is a lead into the moment when he sees the child for the first time. He's just beginning to learn to understand the language of the people he lives among. I understand all that is said to me now in this crude tongue by these plain but kindly people. I have begun to teach the old man's grandson Latin, to write it and to recite poems. Listening to the old man now, telling his stories in our little yard, I know what the different voices signify. They are the north wind, they are wolves, they are giants, they are the ghosts of warriors, they are a shin bone, a severed head, they are the bottom of the sea. The old man's stories are fabulous beyond anything I have retold from the Greek, but savage, a form of extravagant play that explains nothing, but speaks straight out of the nightmare landscape of this place and my dream journeys across it. Our civilized fables that account so elegantly for what we see and how and know seem feeble beside these elaborate and absurd jokes. They are like winter here. They fill the world. They make the head buzz. They numb the blood. They seem absolutely true, yet they explain nothing. I begin to see briefly in snatches how this old man, my friend, might see the world. It is astonishing, bare, cruel, terrible, comic. It begins to be autumn again. There is a smokiness in things. Once again, we go to the birch woods. Almost immediately, in the golden light of a fine autumn day, with the sky broken in rain pools among the drifts of yellow leaves, he is there, standing quite still and taller after these years among the slashed birches. I am filled with joy. He is there. He is real. The others see him too. He is streaked with mud, with bony knees and elbows, and a shrunken belly. An ugly boy of 11 or 12 with a bird's nest of dirty hair. We are sitting, five of us, in a circle, drinking a little of the thin soup we have brought with us, while the horses wander among the birches, grazing off what blades of grass still push up through the leaf mould. It is late afternoon. Still, we hold our cups in both hands, drinking, not speaking, and suddenly the boy is there watching us. The men's eyes dark above the rim of the cup, and their fingers grimy. We all look, first at the boy, then at one another, and are frozen. Even the horses cease grazing and raise their heads against the watery blue of the afternoon, sniffing, scenting another presence. It is as if time had stopped, and I feel that if we could sit like this long enough, cross-legged on the leaves, so that we seemed like another part of the wood, if we let our spirits out, shaking them loose, and became wood, leaf, mould, lichen, he would come to us. The others, I know, are afraid. Their stillness is a sort of terror. These men, who are not afraid of whirling horsemen in the night with poisoned arrows and firebrands, or of a wild boar with its tusks foaming, are afraid of the child. I am not. My stillness is for fear that we may, even with the lifting of a finger or the catching of a breath, startle him into flight. I'm going to read now from the very end of the book, the last page or so. Ovid attempts to teach the child to speak, and to induce out of him some notion of, first of all, the human, then of the Godhead. People of the village drive them out, and they set off across the wilderness towards the pole. And these are the very last, the last two pages of the book. And so we come to it, the place. I have taken my last step, though he does not know it yet, as he moves away as usual to forage for our evening meal. From here I ascend, or lower myself, grain by grain, into the hands of the gods. It is the place I dreamed of so often, back there in Tomis, but could never find in all my wanderings in sleep, the point on the earth's surface where I disappear. It is not at all as I imagined. There are no wolves. It is clear sunlight at the end of a day like each of the others we have spent out here, a fine, warm spring day with larks in the air and insects shrilling under our feet. The child is here. I watch him moving away along the edge of a stream, stooping, kneeling, starting off again with his spring-heeled gait as he gathers snails among the weeds. Strange to look back on the enormous landscape we have struggled across all these weeks, across the sea, across my life in Rome, across my childhood, to observe how clearly the footprints lead to this place and no other. They shine in my head, all those steps. I can in my mind follow them back, feeling myself with each step restored, till I come to the ground of my earliest memories again, and am standing in the checkered light of olives at the very edge of our farm, with wings glittering beyond the low stone wall, and a goat herd dozing against one of the olives, his rough head tilted back and all the throat exposed, as if he had been dozing like that, just as I last remember him, for nearly 60 years. One of the goats, which is black, has just jerked up onto its hind legs to munch at a vine shoot. It is spring, it is summer, I'm 3 years old, I'm 60. The child is there. He turns for a moment to gaze at me across his shoulder, which is touched with sunlight, then stoops to gather another snail from the edge of the stream. He rises and goes on. The stream shakes out its light around his ankles as he wades deeper, then climbs onto a smooth stone and balances for a moment in the sun, leaps, leaps again, then wanders upstream on the other bank, which is gravel. Every pebble of it, white, black, grey, picked out and glittering in the late sunlight as in a mosaic, where he pauses, gathers one, two, four snails, and with the stream rippling as he steps in and out of it, walks on, kicking at the gravel with his toes, and lost for a moment in his own childlike pleasure in being free. I might call to him. I have the voice for that, but do not. To call him back might be to miss the fullness of this moment as it is about to be revealed, and I want so much at the very end here to be open to all that it holds for me. The fullness is in the child's moving away, in his stepping so lightly, so joyfully, naked, into his own distance at last, as he fades in and out of the dazzle of light off the water, and stoops to gather, what, pebbles? Is that what his eye is attracted by now, the greyest, most delicately veined of them? Or has he already forgotten all purpose, moving simply for the joy of it, wading deeper into the light, and letting them fall from his hands, the living and edible snails that are no longer necessary to my life, and may be left now to return to their own? The useless pebbles that, where they strike the ground, suddenly flare up as butterflies, whose bright wings rainbow the stream. He is walking on the water's light, and as I watch, he takes the first step off it, moving slowly away now into the deepest distance, above the earth, above the water, on air. It is summer, it is spring, I am 3 years old, I am 60, I am six, I am there. Thank you.